Hello, my name is Dr. Samuel Kim.
And I'm Sharon Kim.
And welcome to Research Sense for Korean American Therapy, a podcast that removes barriers and gives you a rundown of the latest Korean American mental health research. Hello. Hi, Sharon. How's everything going?
It's going well. How are you, Dr. Sam?
I am super stoked and excited because we have a very special episode today.
Yeah, we do. I'm excited about this as well.
So today we're not talking about a research paper like we normally do. Today, just out of pure coincidence, as I was going through my life here at University of Denver, I noticed a name that seemed very familiar, Dr. Keiko McCullough. And if you remember back, that's a name from two papers that we had talked about on this podcast, one from season 2, episode 5, about the prototypicality model, and then season 1, episode 4, about Asian American YouTubers. And lo and behold, Keiko McCullough ended up being a faculty member at the college that I am at University of Denver. And so today I am super excited to introduce y'all to Dr. Keiko McCullough. So Dr. McCullough, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, thank you for that very warm welcome. My name is Dr. Keiko McCullough, and I am currently an assistant professor in the counseling psychology program at the University of Denver. I'm in my first year as a faculty member, actually ending my first year. It's the last quarter, so moving forward.
I would love to hear kind of about your background, where you're from, and kind of what brought you into the work that you do.
Yeah. So going way back, I grew up in the Midwest in Ohio for most of my life. I did move around a lot. And I come from a mixed family. So my father is white and my mother is a first generation Japanese immigrant. And she became a citizen at some point when I was very young. But I have one sibling and my immediate family's all still in the Midwest. And on my dad's side, everyone's kind of everywhere in the US. And on my mom's side, she was actually the only one who immigrated. So all of her family is still in Japan. So that's kind of some of my early background. I think we're going to spend some time talking a decent amount about academia and what research is like for me. But currently, in terms of my role here at DU, I'm getting my research lab going. I appreciate how y'all have looked at some of the stuff that I've done previously. A lot of that was actually work that I did as a doctoral student. So I'm currently coming up with new projects now as a faculty member, setting up my research lab, getting a number of projects started, and really trying to get students and other faculty involved as well in some of the projects that I'm doing. A lot of my work is interdisciplinary. I do work in research methods. I do work in media studies, media related work. A lot of it's interdisciplinary, and I think it's really important to do interdisciplinary work, but often very difficult to accomplish, which is why there tends to be less of it. But I like to collaborate with people in research methods and in media studies, and I would say generally the really large umbrella of the kind of work that I do. My work really lies at the intersections of critical research methods, psychology, and media studies. And as you're probably aware, I tend to focus on topics like race, particularly AAPI related issues, AAPI related psychology. And I also focus a lot on gender. Historically, that has been in studying masculinities. And I also write a lot of methodological pieces as well.
Wow, that is a lot of information. And boy, I hope you're ready for all the follow-up questions we're about to ask you. So the first one I want to start off with is the term interdisciplinary. I think that's a newer word for our group. How would you define what interdisciplinary means, especially in the world of doing research work?
Yeah, interdisciplinary really just means collaborating across disciplines. And a lot of the time in academia, it's kind of siloed. Like, we exist doing psychology research with our set methods, with our particular things that we tend to study usually, our participant pools that we tend to use. And then we've got other disciplines that just have completely different ways of thinking about things, of doing research, of the kind of things that they actually consider to be research material. There's just so many differences between disciplines. And because of those differences, it can be hard for people to collaborate across disciplines because they just have such rich histories of doing things in certain ways. So interdisciplinary work is really work that bridges different disciplines and tries to create something that's generative, that's at the crossroads of those two different disciplines or multiple different disciplines.
Such a fascinating idea. It's not just that you're researching as a psychologist or someone in the psychology training program. You're thinking about experts who are in other fields and how can we come together to answer some of these bigger questions that we have.
And Dr. McCall, you mentioned that it's usually a challenge to work across disciplines. What are some of the challenges? Me not knowing what that looks like, what are some challenges you come across? And then what are the benefits of working together?
Yeah, some of the challenges are just knowing people, right? Like we so often go to work with the people that we're already introduced to, that we already know, that are in the same building as us, that we're familiar with. So really getting to know people in other disciplines, it can be a barrier. And I wish I had known more people in other disciplines as a doctoral student. And that's something that I'm really making more of an intentional effort to get to know people in other disciplines and to try to collaborate with them now that I'm a faculty member. I mean, particularly because I'm really interested in media-related research. So like I said before, intersections of critical methods, psychology, and media. So I think it's important for me to collaborate as well with media scholars and to be able to gain insights from how they do things and to be able to apply my expertise as a psychologist to be able to answer interesting questions that are in both realms in a way.
I think that's something that a lot of people have misconceptions about. I've often had friends ask me, what do you mean you only know two buildings on campus? It's like, why don't you know your entire campus? And I think an undergraduate student sees a lot more of campus because you're taking classes in a lot of different fields. Whereas when we come in, we specialize in a field and we're kind of just in one building and then other buildings that we happen to teach in. And so it is at times difficult to meet other people from other disciplines that are out there. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, as you kept saying, that your work is this intersection of race and media and those things coming together, it just brought to mind the Asian American YouTuber study that you had worked on. And that just seems like, oh, this must be like a hallmark of the work that you do. Why is media so important? Why is that something that we need to really study and see how that affects people?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I think that there are a number of different reasons why media-related research is important. In our current media-saturated world, daily living experience, something that people often talk about is that representation matters. That's something that I really relate to. Like I said, I grew up in the Midwest and I grew up in a predominantly white area. I didn't know other Asian Americans. And so what I knew of other Asians and Asian Americans was what I saw in the media. And often what I saw wasn't great. And I do think that I internalized some stereotypes and some myths about Asian Americans that I had to later unlearn and challenge a little bit more. And so I think for that reason alone, it's important because it affects us in particular ways. It affects how we view ourselves. It affects how we view other people. And oftentimes it can work in a way that's operating outside of our immediate consciousness. So I think it's important to be able to unpack some of the messages that are there in media and to also critically analyze what we expose ourselves to and what kind of positive and negative representations of particular groups, how that affects our understanding of certain groups, of certain people, of ourselves, our communities. And that's a lot of the work that I aim to do currently. Especially in the quantitative realm, is looking at the relationship between exposure to particular types of media and how that relates to psychological outcomes like self-esteem, racial identity, things like that. And the Asian American YouTuber study that y'all covered is a very on-point representation of the kind of quantitative work that I try to do.
I did want to mention that that episode is one of our highest listened to episodes. So a lot of people are very interested in that work. So that's really cool. And also your other work too, the one on prototypicality model, where you talk about gender and how gender is viewed based on race. That's actually the study I refer to the most when I talk to my friends. I'm like, you'd got to listen to this episode because this one taught me a lot about life, you know, just in general. I do tell them, you know, hey, this is how people are viewed depending on their gender and race, and we need to understand this. And they're like, oh, that makes so much sense. So it really does have an application for our real life, right? And I think a lot of the times we think that research is so siloed that in our everyday life, we don't think that we need it, or we are so far from it that we just think it's too archaic, it's hard to understand. And that's the whole goal of this podcast, is to bring research more approachable and relatable to our lives. And so that's another question I wanted to ask you, is how do you take your work that's normally just siloed in academia, and then how do you bring that to do more advocacy work or something that really affects our everyday lives?
I think that's a great question. And a lot of it has to do with being intentional about the real world applications of the kind of research that you're doing, and to use some of what you see in everyday life to frame your research questions is one way that you can make sure that it is applicable to what's actually happening out in the world. And then I think another piece of it is just taking it the extra step of thinking about, how can I actually apply what I've learned here? And are there particular interventions that I can do? Are there particular policy implications? What can I do now that I've learned this certain thing to really inform and shape different areas out in the real world? And I think that part of why there isn't a ton of that is because that's more work, frankly. But I think that's something that I've found to be important as I move forward in my current work, is to really be thinking critically about what are the real world applications of this. And once I find a certain finding, how can I use that to make some kind of change happen?
I think that's such an important aspect of the work of an academic that most people don't realize. It's like, we're not just holed up in an office just sitting there writing papers all day. Well, I mean, some of us are. But we're thinking about, how are these ideas affecting real people, and how can we work towards bettering other people's lives? And I think for a lot of our listeners who aren't professional researchers or in the world of academia, I think one question that comes up is, how do you decide what to do? What inspires your work? And what inspires you to say, like, oh, this is what I want to study, this is what I want to learn more about? And to be able to say, is it stuff from your background? Is it stuff that you're exposed to? Like, where do these ideas come from?
I'll start with aspects of my background and how that's influenced my work. I didn't know other Asians and Asian Americans growing up. And so once I was an undergraduate, even, and I was studying psychology, when I had the opportunity and the resource and skills to be able to find literature that was relevant and to learn more about Asian Americans, Asian American psychology, I was really just excited to do that. I would just Google Scholar API related things as an undergraduate, and that's how I became familiar with Joel Wong's work. He was the first author on that prototypicality study, and he was my doctoral advisor. So I ended up becoming really familiar with his work through Google Scholar and AAPI related things. And he studies AAPI related issues, masculinities, things like that. And so I applied to work with him and was accepted to work with him as a doctoral student. So I think just wanting to know a lot more about Asian Americans really led me on that path of actually studying Asian Americans. And how do I decide what a topic is? At this point, I like to be creative and realistic. I try to think, what could I reasonably focus on for 2 to 3 years and really commit to and not hate the process of doing it? Because it's a lot of work. Like one study will take you at least a year, usually multiple years. So it is quite a lot of work to produce high quality publishable content for a reputable journal. So I am always really paying attention to what's happening around me and using life experiences and observations to generate my research questions. So going back to that API YouTubers study that I did, thinking about how does watching API YouTubers affect self-esteem, racial identity among API viewers. As a doctoral student at Indiana University, in our library, there are glass rooms. There are like a ton of rooms that you can study in, but you can see inside them. They have glass walls. And I would walk through and I would see groups of API students studying together, and they'd be projecting videos by API YouTubers onto the screen while they're doing other things and just be there, or they'd be watching it. Some people be paying attention. And I really just wondered, what is it like for this generation of younger API college students and viewers to have access to representation in this way at the tips of their fingertips, where they're really watching it, especially in the context of there being so little API representation in traditional media. So it was really a question of just like people are engaging with this content and they're seeing people who look like them. How does that affect them? So that was really how I came up with that particular study.
Hold on a second. I want to emphasize this little point. You were just walking by and saw a group of students watching some YouTube videos, and this kind of started your brain thinking for the study.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not just one time. They're often watching watching things, and I can see it. And I also worked with a lot of API undergraduate students, and they were naming the people they're watching that share identities with them. And it really made me wonder, what is it like to actually be able to see people who look like you, to have this kind of entertainment available to you in a way that I don't think was happening as much when I was really, really young.
So this is what I love hearing, the backstory of how you got that started. Yes, like, oh, as a researcher, you watch students and then, okay, and you're walking by, you get that idea. This is like, I'm watching a movie right now and getting to see all the backstory of how you got that study.
Well, Sharon, maybe we won't say that they were watching
Oh,
students.
okay,
That sounds a little
yeah.
creepy.
I was just lingering. She's taking notes. Watching.
I love that. Love that.
There was another question embedded in those questions around what inspires me. And I do think that generally entertainment I find very inspiring, and also art, images, those kinds of things.
What kind of art?
I love a lot of art. I grew up in Ohio and there's the Cleveland Museum of Art. I don't know if either of you have ever been there. It's one of my favorite art museums, but I feel really inspired by looking at images and looking at art. And I would go, literally once I went with my family and we were going to the Cleveland Museum of Art, and I had prepared discussion questions for us before we went in. I was like, okay, we're gonna sit down and we're gonna talk about what's your favorite art movement, who's your favorite artist, like what, how do you observe art, what do you notice? And I was met with varying degrees of excitement. I would say more tolerance for my behavior. There was some bargaining, like, can we not do this? I'm like, no, we're having fun. I don't think you'll understand this is what fun is. But I feel very inspired by art and entertainment. And also in my qualitative work, I use a lot of visual research methods. And for any aspiring graduate students in psychology, I can recommend the book called A Handbook of Visual Methods in Psychology, Using and Interpreting Images in Qualitative Research by Paula Reavy. I encourage people to give it a read if they're interested in visual methods in psychology, which is something that I think not a lot of people have a ton of exposure to, but I find very interesting. And particularly because I like to analyze media images, I've found that it aligns with my focus, in particularly in my qualitative work. So if anyone is interested in that, I would encourage them to read that book and also to look into some of the qualitative work that I've done in the past if people are interested. It tends to be more gender identity, gender performance related.
sounds
really fascinating. I've actually never heard of visual analysis or looking at art with a critical research eye. And in our show here, this podcast, we've talked about the difference between qualitative and quantitative work. Qualitative tends to be more of this exploration through interviews, and where quantitative tends to be more surveys and data that we collect, lots of numbers that are involved there. If you just had to talk about this art sort of analysis in a nutshell to the everyday person, how would you describe it? Are they looking at this art and trying to figure out what it represents or what it's trying to convey? Or is there something completely magical that I'm not even close to touching?
That's a very fair question. Let me bring it back a little. So if thinking about my work being critical media psychology related stuff in the quantitative realm, I am looking a lot at how exposure to particular types of media is correlated or related to a number of different psychological outcomes. In the qualitative realm, I'm interested in how psychological concepts themselves are constructed in media texts, in photos, for example. So I have one study where I looked at Instagram photos and how masculinities were constructed visually in Instagram photos. So masculinity, like gender identity being a psychological concept to explore, this is another way of exploring that from a more qualitative visual research methods lens.
You know, one of the things I want to come back to is you talked a little bit about some advocacy work that you're doing, like how your work connects to different policies and how that kind of governs stuff. And so I think that might be a bit of a jump for some of our listeners to things like, what do you mean a research study can inform policies or laws or like how things affect one another? Can you talk a little bit about your work in there?
Thus far, in terms of my specific research studies informing policy, that's something that I aim to do, particularly moving forward. In terms of generally, how does research inform policy? Research can be very informative of policy, particularly quantitative research, because I think people find numbers to be persuasive. And so when you're doing quantitative research that says X percent of this population is struggling with this thing, I think people can be more readily convinced to change policy in a way. Quantitative research particularly can be really persuasive, as you can present statistics and things like that that can inform policymakers of resources that need to be allocated or ways that systems need to be changed.
So Dr. McCullough, we have a lot of graduate students who listen to our podcast because they want to stay updated with current research. And what is some advice that you would give to a graduate student or aspiring grad student about to go into psychology?
Yeah, so I have a big interest and professional focus on research. So I will start there with my advice around research specifically, though I can offer a little bit more advice that goes beyond research too. But in terms of research, I would say it's really important to find research topics that genuinely interest you. I think a lot of the time people view research as boring, tedious, a lot of work. And I think a lot of the time it has to do with not really engaging with research that's really motivating and exciting to you. I find a lot of what I study exciting. I'm excited to study what I want to study. And so I want other students to be excited about the research process. And to also be aware that the opportunity to do research is the opportunity to generate knowledge, which is a privilege. As we've talked about before, knowledge can be used to inform so many different things. It can be used to inform advocacy efforts. It can be used to inform policy. It can inform clinical interventions. And so it really is a privilege to be in that space. I know, for example, I used to run an API-focused therapy group. And we would often draw upon research articles that were published in the Asian American Journal of Psychology to really inform some of the topics that we would talk about and to provide some psychoeducation about the things that are out there. And so it really is a privilege to be able to create knowledge in that way and to disseminate it. So I would encourage students to look for gaps in the literature, particularly in relation to understudied populations, and to really use your unique individual strengths and your creativity to fill those gaps. And I say particularly in relation to understudied populations because I'm sure some might be aware that psychological research related to minoritized groups, there isn't a lot of it. And there are a number of reasons for that. I think one of the reasons is that a lot of the time, this kind of research is generated by people who come from that community. And so if you're thinking about a minoritized population in the US, that's already less people numbers wise. And then you think about how many people can actually afford to go to college. And then you think about how many people actually want to take on being a graduate student. How many of them want to go into psychology and become a psychologist and get their PhD? And then of those psychologists, how many of them actually want to do research? And then how many of those who want to do research actually want to study their own community and have the kind of skills and resources to do so? Having, for example, an appropriate mentor to guide them in doing that kind of research. I'm not saying if you belong to a certain community and you're becoming a psychologist, you need to do research on people from your own community. But I think in general, there are many reasons why there is not as much psychological research on minoritized populations. And so we really do need more of it. And if the stars align and you have the skill set and you're presented the opportunity, then I would say go for it.
Wow. There's just so many things that you said that have just captured my attention. I mean, the idea that generating knowledge is a privilege and that's something that we should hold as a privilege and something that is almost sacred. It's like we need to treat this very thoughtfully and mindfully. And then when you kind of put it about the lack of research on the AAPI community, it makes complete sense the way you described it. It's like how few people are interested in this and are going to go through all of these flaming hoops to get to the point where they can generate this kind of research. So if any of our listeners out there have even an inkling of an interest in this, I strongly recommend that you reach out to folks and anyone that you know. Both I and Dr. McCullough are in the field, and I won't speak for Dr. McCullough, but you're welcome to reach out to me and chat with me. And Dr. McCullough, are folks, would they be able to reach out to you via email?
Yeah. And if they find my DU profile, you can probably link it. And that also includes a description of my research lab.
Oh, I think our audience would eat that up.
So adding to what I said about research, more broadly, my number one advice is to find a mentor who will genuinely support you. Ideally, your direct advisor, because that is priceless and it can really make or break your doctoral experience. So how you do that is to really figure out what it is you want to do, what do you want to study, and find someone who will be able to support you in that, who has the expertise to support you in that. And to learn more about their mentoring style, you know, ask a lot of questions during the doctoral interview if you get an interview with them. Ask them directly about their mentoring style. Ask other students, particularly the current faculty members' advisees, what that faculty mentor's mentoring style is. So my number one advice would be to find an advisor that you can have a good professional relationship with.
That's really great. That's really good advice for our graduate students who might be listening to this episode. And thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and advice and even your background in life. I love how you shared about your family. Dr. Sam and I are always about learning about each other's families and how you came to be. And so thank you so much for doing that and sharing vulnerably with us. Thank you for coming on. And thank you everyone for listening to our episode. I hope you found this helpful and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the last episode of Season 3 with us. As we wrap up this season, Sharon and I wanted to express our deepest gratitude for your continued support and engagement. It has been a fantastic journey exploring these insightful research papers with you. We're eager to announce that we're already preparing a lineup of new studies for the next season, and we hope you'll join us for more of our discussions. Thank you for being a part of our community, and we look forward to exploring these new topics together in the upcoming season. Take care, everyone.